Dr. Needham, Real One. Could I ask you, first of all, Dr. Needham, about the circumstances under which you first went to China?
Well, the circumstances were that in 1942, I was almost the only British scientist who knew any Chinese. And I was therefore invited by the government to go and... essentially, it was that I should go and be scientific counselor at the embassy. But that took some time to arrange. And the first idea was that I should go and give some lectures to the Chinese universities as representing the Royal Society, to which I'd been elected some years before. And similarly, Professor Dodds, was it Edward Dodds of Oxford, who had written about the very excellent book about the Greeks and the irrational, he went out on behalf of the British Academy to give some lectures on philosophy to the Chinese. Now, it soon transpired that was all he could possibly do, and he would have to come home after that time. So he did come home in a short while. And however, in my case, it appeared that there was an urgent necessity for Sino-British Science Cooperation Office. And that is what, in fact, we set up. You can't get messages through third secretaries entirely, because they don't understand anything about science, and the things go wrong, badly wrong. So we needed to have a Sino-British Science Cooperation Office, and that's what we set up. And the business was greatly facilitated by the ambassador at the time, Sir Horace Seymour, who was a very understanding person. And we had the notepaper printed and the office in being a long time before London ever recognized it, which just shows the importance of having our man in Havana, more or less. And that was the situation in which I first went to China.
Can you tell me what impact China first made on you when you first saw it?
Well, that was all written down in the Science Outpost, a book which my wife and I edited together. You'll see there a very detailed account of the first 24 hours, for instance, and the effect it had on me.
And what about the Chinese armed forces? Did you have much contact with them at all?
Well, yes, I did. I certainly did. I was advisor to the Chinese National Resources Commission and also to the General Staff. I was Tsansha, which means advisor. And I claim to be the only man who has ever attended a Calypso session in Port of Spain in Trinidad, dressed in Chinese army uniform.
What did you make of the Chinese armed forces at that time?
Well, they were very good in a way, but Chiang Kai-shek's whole strategy was to trade space for time, as he said. And in fact, the Japanese attempt to conquer China badly misfired, because it is the case that if you have to leave one chap behind every culvert and every small bridge to guard it, you run out of manpower in the course of time. And that's exactly what happened to the Japanese. And in fact, a lot of the Japanese penetration of China was only along the main lines and main roads, so that magistrates were still being appointed from Chongqing in the back blocks for years and years after the Japanese so-called conquest of China.
What impressed you about the Chinese armed forces?
Well, I don't know that I had a lot of contact with the forces in the field, but they were very, very good, I think, in their way.
The Kuomintang regime seems to get a very bad write-up nowadays.
Mm.
Do you think that the picture that we get of the Kuomintang regime nowadays is an accurate one from your own personal observation?
Yes, I think it is. I think it was. It certainly was. The embassy advisors all had the same point of view about the Kuomintang. It was hopelessly corrupt. And everybody said that the communists would certainly take power afterwards. It wasn't a surprise for the British embassy staff.
That was even thought in the British Embassy, was it?
Oh, yes, certainly.
Can you give any illustrations from your personal experience of the weakness of the Kuomintang regime?
No, I don't think I could.
Which particular areas were you mainly travelling in?
Well, all over China. Everywhere where the Japanese were not.
Well, did you ever suffer from any Japanese bombing raids?
No, they had stopped just before I got to Chungking. They'd been very bad before that time, but the Flying Tigers of General Chenault had put a stop to it by the time I got there.
What was the national morale of the Chinese with whom you came into contact with regard to the outcome of the war with Japan?
Well, I think many people believed that the communists would take control eventually.
But as far as defeating the Japanese were concerned, were people confident that it could be done quickly, or were they resigned to a long campaign?
They resigned to a long campaign, I think, yes.
Did you ever speak to any of the leading officers in the Chinese armed forces?
Well, I knew the generals quite well, yes. I met them at receptions and so on in Chungking.
Were there any that made a particular personal impression on you?
Well, I mean, I knew Ho Ying-jin very well and so on. And I was particularly familiar with Yu Dawei, who was the intendant of supplies, the supply officer in charge of the arsenals and all that, because I visited many arsenals. You see, the point was that we dealt with war science as well as peace science, and for peace science we were under the British Council, and for war science we were under the Ministry of Production. And I often used to visit the arsenals, and the 42nd and the 31st and so on. And I always gave as the example, if they broke a piece of their metallurgical microscope, we would get another one, a replacement in from India for them. And in fact, everywhere I went was it was to visit arsenals and university labs and so on, and do whatever help we could by way of bringing in apparatus. I remember on one occasion this extended to white rats for dietary experiments, and I remember they came in General Carton de Wyatt's private plane from India, and he really jibbed at that. He said he didn't think that the white rats was a suitable thing to be carrying about on his private plane.
One might have thought that they might have been obtained in China itself.
No, the white rats have to be bred specially, you know.
As far as the communists were concerned, did you come across Chinese who would openly express communist sympathies to you at that time?
No, I don't think so.
Or was it implicit in anything people would say to you?
Well, I mean, everybody was pretty sure they would get the better of it in the end. The Kuomintang would go down like a pack of cards when eventually, if it came to a tussle between the two.
Did you meet Chiang Kai-shek and Madame Chiang Kai-shek themselves?
I didn't really meet her to any extent, but I certainly knew him. He was always called the peanut, wasn't he, by General Stilwell. And this might seem to be very strange, because he was always photographed from a low level with a long cloak and so on, and gave the impression of a very not only high and mighty but tall personage, but it wasn't the case at all. He was rather small.
In what way did his personality come across when one met him?
Well, it was a person used to command. He was obviously a commander. That was the impression I had when I met Mountbatten, and candy. Exactly the impression. Used to being obeyed.
Did you like Chiang Kai-shek?
No, I didn't really.
Because of this authoritarian man?
Yes, that's quite. Mm.
Did you detect any particular bias for or against Western people in his manner?
No, I don't think so.
How long were you in China at that time?
Well, 4 years. 4 years, and when I came back it was to build up the Natural Science Department of UNESCO.
What were the main changes that you saw in China over those 4 years, would you say?
Well, it was very medieval. It has always remained rather medieval. It took the communist regime to change all that, which it completely changed today. But it was rather medieval then. I remember sitting in a tea house in Sichuan with the Australian Minister Plenipotentiary, namely Sir Frederick Eggleston, and the drains were going down the centre of the village street and so on, and he said, "This place is absolutely medieval in character. You could expect a knight and men-at-arms to come riding down the street any minute." So I said to him, "Yes, but it wouldn't be a knight, it would be a civilian bureaucrat, and he'd be preceded by a lot of chaps carrying placards of his titles and dignities, and the use of force would be very well hidden in the background. No clanking about, no knights clanking about with armour in those days."
From the point of view of health, did you personally stay healthy during those 4 years?
Yes, I did. Mm. Of course, I had to have inoculations quite a lot. Before I went down to the southeast, I had the Hafkin plague vaccine, which was very unpurified in those days and gave me a temperature of about 105 for 5 days. It was a terrible thing. Of course, it's been purified now.
So the backwardnesses in the country didn't seem to be a threat to one's health, by and large?
Well, I mean, it depended on your inoculations. You had typhoid and so on, anti-typhoid.
Coming on to the Korean War, could I ask you about your contact with the controversy that there was at that time about the allegations of American use of bacteriological warfare in Korea?
Well, I still firmly believe in that. The whole thing is a big story, a long story, but I would like to say that the Japanese had tried it already in Changsha, and I gave a report on that in my capacity as scientific counselor of the embassy, which is somewhere in the archives of the Foreign Office now, but it would probably take the earth to unleash it or to unloose it. I don't know whether you might be able to, but anyway, there is a report there in the files somewhere around about 1944, I should think, and I forget what method was used, but the Americans, when they took over Unit 731, which was a Japanese army unit of bacteriological warfare, I still think they tried it out on all kinds of vectors, living vectors of diseases, and without much success. We never could get figures of mortality or morbidity from the Chinese, but nevertheless, I don't think it did much damage.
Did you actually visit Korea at that time?
Yes, oh yes, certainly. We were in North Korea, yes. And we slept in a dugout, and the sentry was killed on one occasion by a bombing raid from the south.
Can you tell me what kind of a state North Korea was in at that time?
Well, a pretty normal state, I should think.
But was it not devastated by the bombing and the war?
Well, to some extent it had been, yes.
Well, what was the morale of the Koreans you came across?
Well, I mean, it was pretty high, as far as I could see. I don't speak Korean, so it was rather difficult to be sure, but I think it was quite high.
Can you recollect what particular stage of the war it was that you visited North Korea?
Well, it was in the year 1952. It must have been 52.
Did you?
I think it was. All our work was done in 52.
Were you able to move about pursuing your investigation?
Oh yes, quite all right. Quite all right. Everything was put at our disposal in North Korea and in China and Manchuria.
Who were your companions on that particular visit?
Well, there was quite a number. It was the International Commission on the Investigation of Bacteriological Warfare in China and Korea, to give it its full name, was set up by the World Peace Council. And my reason for joining it was because during the war, I had got to know quite intimately a number of Chinese bacteriologists, and they were now being spat upon and questioned, and I thought I ought to go to their assistance. That was my reason for going, as a biochemist as I was then. That was my reason for going. But as regards to other things, other people on the commission, there was Professor Pessoa from Brazil, and a chap called Graziosi from Italy, whom I met the other day. He came. He's grown much older now, like me, and so on. But he remembered me, and he came to see me the other day. And of course, there was a Russian. There was Zhukov. He was a bacteriologist himself.
Any other British people?
No, there was no other British person, as far as I know.
Did you find that Graziosi is still of the opinion that?
Oh yes, he is too. Yes, he certainly thinks so. I don't think any of us have changed our minds. Zhukov is probably dead, and Pessoa may well be dead too, but I think they all agreed. And another thing I'd like to emphasize is that this opinion was not based on evidences given by the pilots who were in captivity. The American pilots had a lot to say, but I didn't pay any attention to what their evidence was, because anybody would say anything when in captivity. It was all circumstantial evidence. The evidence of peasant farmers who had seen millions of ants crawling about and so on, unusual phenomena, flies particularly, buzzing, you know. And after containers had been released from American aircraft and so on. It was all based on circumstantial evidence. But I think the revelations which have taken place since then, which you can find in many Japanese periodicals, have shown that this was a great speciality of the Unit 731 of the Japanese Army, based on Harbin. And that leads me on to say that I'm wondering whether the Imperial War Museum would like to have all my notes.
Yes, I'm sure they would.
Because there is a... You see, this is the wrong place to have come, really. We ought to have arranged to meet in my room in college, in Keyes. Because that is where all the notes are. And I could show you that, and also the pile of correspondence about it afterwards. And many papers I've kept of the revelations in the Japanese press about Unit 731. But I'm wondering where they should go at my demise, and I think the Imperial War Museum would be quite a good place.
Well, our museum has what we call a Department of Documents, which is a documentary archive.
Yes.
And I'm quite certain they would be most interested.
Mm. Good.
You talked about the fact that you didn't place emphasis on what the US pilots told you.
No.
How much contact did you have with any British POWs in Korea?
None at all.
Can you recollect which particular parts of North Korea you visited?
Well, we got down as far as Pyongyang, and that was really all I can remember. I mean, there, if we were in college, you see, we could look it up. We could look up the notes, because it's all in the notes. But I don't remember offhand any other cities visited. I certainly did go to other places.
Did you suffer...
One of the amusing things was Alan Winchingham. Winnington.
Winnington, yes.
That's right. He was there at the same time. And along the Yalu River, which separates China from Korea, there was several places where there was only one line of traffic. And so I got out of the truck that I was in and directed the traffic for some time to get around the difficulties. And Alan Winnington came by and said, well, I never expected to see a Cambridge professor directing the traffic along the Yalu River.
Had he known you before?
No, I don't think so, no. Only by reputation.
You didn't come across another journalist who was in Korea at that time, an Australian called Wilfred Burchett, did you?
Well, I think I did meet him, yes, I did meet him, but I didn't know him at all well.
Did you suffer in any way from any action by the British government?
No, nothing at all, nothing at all. Well, what I was saying was you asked whether there were any other effects. And the answer is I wasn't in any way affected in either in the Fellowship of the Royal Society or in Cambridge at all. And I got some support in very unexpected quarters. For example, Patrick Hadley was professor of music in Cambridge and fellow of Caius. And he had been wounded in World War I, and he had very strong views about the gentlemanly ways of conducting warfare and the ungentlemanly ways. And so he supported me very strongly because he felt that bacteriological warfare was a very ungentlemanly way of conducting war. And the only other thing that happened was that Sir Henry Dale, who was a very patriotic person, and I think president of the Royal Society at that time, he wrote to me and said that he could no longer put me up for the Athenaeum. But this was not any great loss because I always felt that the Oxford and Cambridge Club was really much better. And I remember an amusing story about the Dean of York, Eric Milner White, whom I saw breakfasting once at the Oxford and Cambridge Club. And I said, that's very strange. I said to one of the waiters, that's very strange. I thought he belonged to the Athenaeum. So he said, yes, he does, sir. But he always comes here to breakfast.
The outbreak of the Korean War has always been a matter of controversy as well, because the standard version of it that's always accepted in the West is that the North attacked the South.
Mm.
But that has been challenged by a minority in the West. What are your own personal feelings?
Well, I would be with the minority. I think it was a nonsensical charge.
For what reason?
Well, I don't know. I haven't been into the history of it for many years now, but I should be with the minority, I think. I mean, it was a bit like the Tonkin Gulf incident later on.
The escalation of the Vietnam War.
Yes.
And you were referring earlier to the predictions of the Chinese with whom you came into contact in 1942 about the eventual communist takeover.
Yes.
Could I ask you about your own reflections about what's happened in China since 49, about whether or not you think those expectations were fulfilled?
Well, I think they were for a time, because I think Mao Zedong was a very great man, and I think he will always go down in history as a great man, a man who led the Chinese into their promised land, like Moses. But I'm not at all sure about the things that are happening at the present time. I did think at one point that it was a good idea to go over to a mixed economy, but I'm not quite sure that it really is. I'm not sure it's not going too far. But there's a great controversy in China at the moment about whether it's going too fast and too far, isn't there?
Yes, and you rather feel that it is, do you?
Well, I don't know. I simply don't know. I always say when people ask me questions about China today that I'm not a international politician, and nor am I a futurologist. We deal with the history of science, technology, and medicine in China in this place.
What about the Cultural Revolution? Did you feel that it was what it purported to be on the surface, or do you consider it was just a struggle for power?
Well, I really don't know. I don't know. It's too much modern history for me. But it seems to have been a terrible mistake in many ways. I mean, I know many scientists and technologists and engineers who suffered greatly under it. And in fact, I think I wrote about it at one point when, in Nature, when I came back one year, and I said that it was really like a heresy of Maoism, because it took the line that any young man who could do vector calculus or something that other people couldn't do would be likely to feather his own nest and not to have any regard for the masses of the people as a whole. And this was a complete calumny, because lots of the intellectuals had very good social consciences. Then in 1976 or 74, I forget which it was, he died eventually. He was gaga, I think, during the last few years, and he couldn't really manage the Cultural Revolution, so it got off the handle. And then came the arrest of the Gang of Four and so on. But I really don't know. It's too recent history for me.